From the number one best-selling author of Life Rescripted, you're now tuning in to the Year of Purpose podcast. I'm Zephan Moses Blacksburg. Sergeant Kevin Briggs, also known as the Guardian of the Golden Gate Bridge, is a California Highway Patrol officer who encouraged upwards of 200 people to either not go over the rail or come back to solid ground from the cord of the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. After retiring in 2013 from 23 years of service, he has gone on to deliver a TED Talk and founded Pivotal Points. Kevin, thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, I really wanted to share with the audience first that I heard you speak, and I think that you have such an important message that you're sharing with so many people that it was so important to me to bring you on the show and just kind of dive into a little bit about how you came to be known as the Guardian of the Golden Gate Bridge and a little bit of your history, because oftentimes we see these people that we recognize as heroes and we don't realize that they were ordinary people at one point in time who, you know, chose to do something extraordinary. And so I'd love to just hear a little bit of your backstory and, you know, how did you ultimately come to be part of the California Highway Patrol, and what was life like before then?
Sure. Well, I'll go rather quickly through this, but right out of high school, I went into the Army. And for 3 years, when I was stationed over in Germany, I developed testicular cancer. So they sent me back here to the States, to San Francisco, in the Bay Area where I'm from, and I had some surgeries and chemotherapy and everything. Got all through that, and I worked with my father in San Francisco for a year, and my brother-in-law suggested law enforcement. So I applied for a Department of Corrections, and I got into that. For the next 3 years, I worked for 2 years at San Quentin out of those 3 years. And when I was working at San Quentin, a good friend of mine who works there was saying he said he was going out for the California Highway Patrol. And I always looked and go, wow, those guys are squared away. I don't know if I could do that. But he kept on, you know, bugging me about it. Come on, man, go with me. So I said, okay, I'll give it a shot. So went in and applied, got accepted, and I made it, and he did not. So, poor guy. But I started in 1990 with the California Highway Patrol and started in a place called Hayward, which is just south of Oakland. And a lot of gangs, a lot of violence, you know, a lot of good people, but there's a lot of stuff going on down there. So it took me about 4 years before I can get up to Marin County, where I'm from. And for those who don't know where Marin County is, San Francisco connects to Marin County via that Golden Gate Bridge. So I started working there in 1994, and that's when I started working on the bridge, and I really, really enjoyed it because I met people each and every day from around the world, and I just like being down there. I can go into Sausalito for lunch or San Francisco, and it was just a lot of fun, the different things that happened down there. But, you know, the bridge also has this very dark side of it, and that's the suicides. And I didn't realize how many suicides were there, took place there every year. And I had no training when I first started. It was horrible. It was terrible when I would get these calls because, you know, we all have empathy. And to roll up onto someone, to get that call that someone is over that pedestrian rail, and then to go up to them, and I didn't know what to say. I felt very responsible for whatever they may do. So it was tough those first few years. It really was.
Yeah, I can certainly imagine, especially without any particular training, because that's not exactly a conversation that really anyone has experienced to just dive into and get started. And it's such a heated situation. I feel like you're really putting a lot on the line, both yourself and, you know, and they've got a lot on the line. So it's got to be quite possibly one of the toughest parts of the job. I want to just kind of jump into a little bit about, you know, do you know why they didn't give you any training? Is there more training for this now? I mean, you know, why is it that they would put you in a position where you don't necessarily have the experience to begin with to speak to these people when it's such a tough scenario?
You know, my only guess on that is back then, maybe they didn't go to these types of calls so much. We are guided in our training through what's called POST, Peace Officer Standards and Training, and I'd like to touch on that a little bit later to tell you how far we have progressed. But every peace officer in California has to go through, you know, like, let's say 15 hours of driving, and then under the influence DUIs and shootings and uses of force, so we all have the same basic training. But they didn't have much for this. It wasn't recognized as much at all. It's better today. It really is.
Yeah, it seems like it's something that people are a lot more willing to talk about, to say the least. I think that it's starting to be public knowledge that we can discuss this in a safe environment. I've got a couple of questions here, actually. I kind of posted up on Facebook before we got on the interview and just kind of sent a message out there to people saying, hey, what would you want to ask if you were on this interview with us? And so I just want to go through a few of those and definitely want to jump into post and learn more about that. But someone said, I want to know what keeps him going. How does he maintain his own positive mindset? And this question definitely resonates with me because I know having worked a job that I absolutely hated, I had so many people coming in day after day. I was in a tech support role and they're bringing me broken stuff. And it's very hard to keep optimistic when your whole job is to see things that are broken or not working all day. So, how do you keep yourself going when you're in such a stressful situation and you're experiencing, many negative mindsets?
Right. And as far as today and how things are going, things that I do is I travel all over and present to folks about the experiences that I had on the bridge and my own experiences with depression. But it's ongoing, but it's really cool is even though I have to relive these experiences every time that I go out and speak, after I speak, I get to meet so many nice people and they come up and tell me their stories and it's a bonding experience and it's my therapy. So, but I still suffer from depression. I realized that even though that I was a cop for this many years, we're not these superheroes. Things can happen to us and they do happen to us and all the different things that we see are things that you're not supposed to see a lot of times, these horrific traffic accidents, and when we lose someone on the bridge, and the different things that we're called to, and they take a toll on you. And if you don't get some help for that, the average lifespan typically of a cop after when they retire is about 5 years.
Wow.
So, and part of that is not only heart disease and such, but because we've seen so many things that we didn't get the help, and now we might become suicidal and all this different stuff happens to us. So, and I'll tell you the what's happening with me is now I'm on two different medications for depression. I just started a different medication. So even though here I am 53 years old and such, it still requires me to go in and get checked out. I still go through therapy and it's nothing to be embarrassed about. This is what's happening. If I want to live life to the fullest that I can and be functional, this is what helps me do it. So I have two boys, ages 15 and 13, and they're very big into sports, and I just love going watching them play their sports, that kind of thing. So, a support group is absolutely critical. But having that mindset to where if you're not feeling right for a couple of days, we all have these bad mental health days. But when that starts turning into a couple of weeks, there's a problem. And it's not, don't be ashamed to go seek help about this.
So it's certainly about knowing when it's more than just, having a bad weekend or having a bad day, and knowing when it's time to go and seek out help. And so it sounds like, it's if this goes on for more than like 2 or 3 days, it's probably time to reach out to someone, look for, someone who can just listen, or maybe even reach out for professional help at that point. And, I've certainly done this in the past too. I've suffered from depression as a teenager growing up, and I certainly have my days now where, it's not always the best. I'm lucky enough that I don't need medication anymore, but I think that it's really crucial to stress that, using medication is not a sign of weakness. It's kind of like a tool that allows us to get to where we need to be. And I think, there's a lot of different perspectives on that. But I want to just kind of like rewind to, if you can maybe remember that first day or that first experience, what sort of messages are going on in your head, as you maybe you park the car and walk up over onto the bridge? What's going through your head? What are you thinking at the time? And then maybe let's go into a little bit of, what's kind of the protocol or the process that you were ultimately trained to use in having these conversations?
Sure. Well, and I don't recall everything from back then in 1994 or so, but I remember it was a younger woman over the rail around midspan. And I kind of walked up with a mindset of, what are you doing? what are you doing over there? Like she was a trespasser. Like, you can get hurt. You better come back over here. I didn't fathom it so much that she may be suicidal. And I totally didn't understand about mental illness. So my approach and how I interacted with her wasn't anything about how I do now, how I would now. But after that first one, and she did come back over the rail. I think she had a lot of empathy for me, really. I was scared. You know, I don't want to have someone lose their life in front of me, or if at all. So I feel very responsible for that. And, you know, after I did what I could, and she did come back over. But after that, you know, I started seeking out the older officers, the veterans, and started talking to them and say, wow, I didn't realize this occurred quite frequently. So what can I do if I'm going to work down here to better myself, to be more prepared for this, to not only help myself to get through this, but to really to help those folks to come back over that rail? You know, they're in this mindset for generally a brief time. And if we can get them past that, get them over that rail, then there's a big chance that they won't try this again.
Yeah, no, I think it's just so interesting to hear all of this, because I think that, you know, I've driven over that bridge. I was just in San Francisco maybe a year and a half ago. And one of the questions that just popped up for me that someone posted online was, if you had a chance to talk to these people maybe a month before, you know, when you find them on the bridge, like, what would you even ask or say to them? I mean, are they exhibiting any signs physically? Are they behaving in a certain manner that could even just give us some sort of a red flag or a warning sign that something bad might happen?
That is a great question. And absolutely, most folks will show signs in one way or another. And I read a lot. I do a lot of Google alerts now, and just from my own experiences, most folks will actually talk about it or write about it. And we miss these things. We think that they're joking or something. You know, things like, you'll be better off without me. Something really simple like that. But that's my main objective now, is to get to folks long before they get up to that bridge or anywhere, you know, put a gun to their head or on top of a building, whatever they may be thinking of doing. That's the big ticket here, is to get to folks way before that. Because when they're on that, I look at it like a stage four cancer. It's very, very difficult at that time to deal with that. So if we can get to them long before they get up to those positions, we have a much better chance of them having a very positive outcome. But you're looking at things, inconsistencies. If I just had to really put it down to just one sentence, you know, look for inconsistencies in that individual's behavior. Maybe they're giving away their belongings that they would have never done before. Helplessness, hopelessness, you know, believing that things are terrible and never going to get better. The maybe increased drug or alcohol use, not being able to communicate any future plans is a really big one. We all have plans. We all have things that are going on. Increased or really decreased amount of sleep. And when people start using drugs or alcohol a lot, and they're sleeping a lot, they do that for a reason, because then they don't feel that the pain that they're in. So, you know, they start doing that. Financial stressors are a big ones, you know, divorce, your loss of income, diagnosed with an illness, a big time illness, you know, that can set things off. So there's a lot of different things that we can look for. And that doesn't mean a person is suicidal, but we want to check on them. We want to check on them just to see, you know, maybe they're just having a tough time going through things. And if people know that there's someone in their corner, that is a huge plus in their life.
Right. But if we're, you know, especially because this is something that's probably unfamiliar to many of us, you know, you even said on the first one that you were called out for, you know, you were kind of walking up thinking like, hey, what are you doing? Like, this is unsafe. How can we best, you know, how do we even open up that conversation to someone and just be really, really, I don't know, vulnerable or just open to where they are? Because, you know, you don't know if they're just doing a really dumb stunt, you know, or if they're actually in a really poor mental state. And it's very hard to tell that. how can we kind of open up that discussion? I mean, are we just saying, hey, are you okay? You know, sometimes a lot of people will just say, oh, I'm fine, and shake it off and won't want to talk. How can we kind of convince them to open up a little bit further?
Right. This is a tough conversation. I can't really think of a tougher one. You know, this is what we call a very courageous conversation that has to take place. You're looking at someone's life, possibly. We don't know, but can you imagine if you didn't approach and speak with them and then they did lose their life to suicide? Look at the regret. Look at that loss of life. But what I think, in my personal opinion, if I saw someone suffering like that, and just to find out what's going on, if they will tell you a place where they're comfortable, and I'm not talking about a coffee shop or a restaurant or the library or somewhere out in the open, because what you're asking these folks to do is really break down and tell you what's going on. They may break down and start crying and whatever else. You want to have them in a place where they're comfortable, where they can do that if need be. And ask them, hey, this is what I've seen. I've seen this, 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 and this. And I just wanted to let you know that I'm worried about you. And let them talk. If they're talking, that's phenomenal. What we teach as negotiators is 80-20. And we look at, if those folks are talking, let them talk 80% of the time, with me talking 20% of the time. I'm not going to be able to get any information if I'm talking most of the time, right? I need them to be talking. So give them your full attention, a lot of minimal encouragers, to where if they're speaking to me, I'm letting them know that I'm paying attention but not interrupting them. Things like, wow, is that so? Really? Just little things like this, so we don't interrupt them, but they continue on. And then you want to normalize their feelings. And that's huge, because these people a lot of times feel that they're alone and nobody understands what's going on with them and nobody has been through what they're going through. But if we can normalize this, something like saying, you know what? A lot of people, if they're going through all these things that you have, they may be thinking about killing themselves. Have you been having thoughts of killing yourself? And let them answer and be prepared for that yes. Don't freak out and say, how could you do this to me? How could you do this to your family? Or get angry. That's stupid. Don't do that. You're a coward. Be ready for that answer and have some information with you to provide to that person. All right, well, let's talk about this. You know, have you tried this before? And if you have tried it before, well, what stopped you? So let's try to give some information. And if they're suicidal right then, I've had enough. This is it. We need to get some help right now. Then don't let them be by themselves.
And so it sounds like you can really open up a conversation and ask them about suicide. I mean, that's something that I almost originally would have thought, that you don't even want to bring that up. You just want them to keep talking about their life and the good things. But it sounds like you can be very open with them in those moments and encourage them to talk about their feelings and in a sense be relatively blunt.
You know what? That's what I would say. And not every conversation needs to lead to this. If the person just says, no, I'm just having a couple of rough days, I'm doing fine, you know, next, and in 6 months, I'm going on this great vacation, and it's going to be a lot of fun, and I got this planned in 3 months. Okay, so they do have a future going on. They have something planned. But if they come around and say, you know, I don't think I can make it through next week, or I have this going on, and it's just way too much for me, and they sound like they're giving up on life, then we need to step it up and ask them. You know, it's a very tough question. It's hard to ask, but look at what could happen if we don't. You know, this could be a life changer for people.
So we talked a little bit about how to recognize some early red flags. Someone else actually just posted to me online. They said, if we don't have the opportunity to talk to them well in advance, if you had a chance to just take a big sign and just put it on the bridge, that would make people think twice. First, is there anything you think you could put on there that might change their mind? And then second, what would you put on there if you feel like that would make a difference?
You know, I heard of a bridge, and I forget the country, it might be Korea, that they actually have like a movie screen, but a very small one or something, that goes along the railing of the bridge. And it shows, you know, happy times and happy moments, and I guess there is help and all these different things. So that's what I would say. But I know as far as the Golden Gate Bridge, They are putting up a suicide barrier, and it's going to go up in 2017, and that will greatly diminish the number of suicides on that bridge. But just something so folks know, there is help, there is hope. Something to that effect.
That's a pretty simple message, but I think it can make a huge difference. And that's great news that they're going to be making a difference, next year and putting up that barrier. I think I did see an article a little bit about that. I think it's like a netting that kind of extends to the point where, you just can't make it off the side of the bridge. Is that right?
Right. I've spoken with the architect of the bridge a couple of times now. Very nice man. And it's going to be about 20 feet down from the roadway and extend about 20 feet out. And it's going to be in segments with, I guess, these steel girders that go out. And then it's going to be a net, like a 6-inch diamond-shaped metal, because it's a marine environment net, so to speak. And if someone decides to jump and they land in this, it's going to be very, very loose, and that netting is going to kind of encapsulate them. They're going to sink quite a ways into this. So then we'll get the fire department to come out, and they're going to have to go over maybe with a cherry picker or something and get these folks out. And they'll take that whole segment out, and then they'll have other ones standing by, and they'll put that new segment back in.
So the segment would be completely replaced after that?
Right. So it's pretty neat.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. Not to take it too dark, but I know that you're definitely in a role where sometimes certain things don't go as planned. Could you maybe share just a little bit about, maybe a time where, you weren't able to save somebody, and how do you come back from that, and really tell yourself that you did the best you could?
Right. Well, one of the guys who I don't speak when I present, I don't speak about this individual too often, but we got a call of a man over the rail, and this was an African American man, oh, maybe 30 years old, something to that effect. And I got there, and there were two other officers with me who had about the same time on that I did, so we were well seasoned. And we started talking with this young man. And he was not under the influence of alcohol or drugs. Very nice man. He would answer our questions, but he wouldn't tell us his name, and he wouldn't tell us what had transpired to bring him to this point to where he was there. But he was just a very nice guy. I don't know what he did, but he shook my hand, not once, but three times. And on that third time, he shook my hand, and I told him my name, of course. And he tells me, he goes, "Kevin, I want to thank you for everything, but my grandmother's down there and I have to go." So his grandmother had passed away sometime prior. So he shook my hand that third time, and then he jumped. And it hits you really hard. We had developed a bond. I'm there to save life. That is what we try to do. So to lose someone, we take it personally. It's a big hit, and it's a loss of life, and you think about their friends and family. But to have that connection where he shook my hand, it's even worse. So, it's a big failure on my part, I believe. But what helps us get through it is the number of folks who we talk to that do come back over that rail. And I don't really call it a save, so to speak, because I'm not grabbing them and pulling them back over. But I look at it more as a conduit for them on a very, very dark day in their life. And I don't reach out and grab these folks for a couple of reasons. One, I don't want to be pulled over, and I highly doubt they would do it because these folks don't want to hurt anybody but themselves. But also, to come back over that rail takes a lot of courage. I, or whoever is speaking to them on that bridge, am not going to be able to solve their problems, their issues of why they went over. It's not going to happen. We know that, and I'm not going to lie to them about that. So it takes a lot of courage to come back over that rail and face all of that stuff again.
Yeah, it certainly does. And I don't want to round off the episode on a sad note here, so I want to talk about a couple more things. I know that you mentioned earlier a little bit about post. Could you share just expand on that a little bit? And then I've got maybe two more questions before we let you go.
Sure. And this is around the United States. Every peace officer has to go through a certain number of hours of training for all these different things that we do. And for California, it's called POST, Peace Officer Standards and Training. And it's ironic that we're having this conversation because I was called to, for next week, next Monday and Tuesday, Wednesday, I'll be in Sacramento developing with some other folks, developing policy for all the police officers, sheriffs, highway patrol, all the officers in California of how to recognize and handle these types of calls. So we're developing new policy and training requirements for this. So this is how far we've come now. It's going to be really, really cool to do this. So it's going to be standardized practice for every peace officer in California. And this is what we're developing. This is how far we've come. And it's just great that we're allowed and going through this.
Yeah, I think it's awesome that we're recognizing that, you know, training more and more people on this is going to be so crucial just for, you know, everyone out there. And I'd love to hear, you know, did you ever have someone where you were called out on a call and, you know, someone's on the bridge and they chose to come back over the railing? Have you caught up with anyone, you know, 10, 15 years later or seen where their life has gone? Has anyone come back to find you to thank you afterwards?
You know, I received a couple of emails, so to speak, after I did a TED talk about folks I had dealt with. But one person in particular, and I will tell you this, preface it with this, that I don't reach out to people generally because it could be a trigger. You know, that's a very dark day in their life. And for me to come back and say, hey, I'm the guy who talked to you and then you came back over and stuff. For one, I think that's kind of egotistical. It's not my job to do that. But also, you know, this could be a trigger for them to go back, not suicidal, but to have, you know, a negative mood or a negative time in their life again. And I don't want to be a trigger for that. So I don't contact them. One individual who I have kept in contact is a guy named Kevin Berthia, and he's an African male who was over the rail, and his picture's been around quite a bit. You can see that on the website, and you know, all around the web, kind of. So he was over the rail. He came back, and now he gets a chance to go out and speak about everything that brought him to the bridge that day, and how he's doing now, and how we can overcome this depression and these different things that are happening to us. So he's a great success story.
That's awesome. It's so great to hear, you know, not only seeing someone who can take the courage to get back over the rail and come back, but to kind of go out there and share their story, because, you know, it's a tough thing to talk about, you know. And I certainly appreciate you taking the time out of your day to share your story as well. And Kevin, I'd love to share with everyone how they can find, you know, I know you have a TED Talk out there, and you also travel around a lot speaking. Where can people find out more about you and what you're doing, as well as to watch that video?
Sure. If they just go on to the TED Talks, they'll find it there. You know, just punch in Kevin Briggs TED Talk or something. And my website it's actually pivotal-points. So www.pivotal-points.com. And they can learn more about the website. If they have questions about things, we have a lot of different things that people to look at, how to help others, and there's quite a bit of stuff on there.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much for being here, Kevin. And if you had just one last little tidbit of wisdom or any, you know, one line sort of quote you'd want to share with everyone about, you know, how worthwhile it is to be here and to enjoy this life, what would you say?
You know, I have this little mantra of mine for folks who are talking to other people, and just listen to understand. That's the big thing.
I love it. I think that's perfect. Thanks so much for being here today, Kevin, and I certainly look forward to keeping in touch with you.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Hey everyone, it's Zeph. Did you like this episode? Be sure to subscribe so that you can tune in next week and tell a friend about the show. If you want access to free training and exclusive interviews on success, happiness, lifestyle design, and adventure, visit me at yearofpurpose.com. Until next time, go out and let life surprise you so that you can live a life rescripted.